This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. Go to Google News this morning, type in North Carolina. You will not see much about politics on the first line, or health care, or the pending state legislature vote on the lottery. Those will not be on the first line. The top story today is University of North Carolina men's basketball team returning to the NCAA tournament Final Four. This trip, clinched by a 6-point win over Wisconsin Sunday, will be the Tar Heels' 16th, and that is the most of any program. Our own Dave DeWitt is here to recap the weekend and look ahead to the Final Four. Dave, welcome.
Great to be here, Frank.
Tar Heels have been there 16 times. What makes this one special?
Well, a couple of things. One, it's the first time Carolina's been there since 2000, 5 years. Now, most programs would think, wow, we were there 5 years ago. Wow. It's a dynasty. We got a dynasty going on here. But right. At North Carolina, they believe it's their birthright. The Final Four is their own special. That's how they end the season at North Carolina. They've been to 16 of them. Yeah. Not one in 5 years, and not one since this group has been there, including the head coach, Roy Williams. It's his second season. He was there with Kansas more recently, but now he's at North Carolina. And all the players who are there now haven't been to a Final Four. Not only that, but they had to endure a season 2 years ago where they were 8-20. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot different, and it's a different mentality. It's newer to the people who are there. And for some, that means more excitement and even more thrilling than the 15 previous.
A lot more excitement. It may be their birthright, but they really had to work for it over the weekend.
They really did. They played two very good games against Villanova and Wisconsin, both very different teams, different styles. And Carolina won both games, and they won them in pretty close games. Both were pretty thrilling. The win over Villanova, there was a controversial call against Villanova, a traveling call that sort of helped Carolina clinch that win. And then the win over Wisconsin was tied at halftime, 3-point game late. Carolina ends up winning by 6. Now, in anybody's book, that's a pretty good game. Over the weekend, it was the most disappointing game of all four. The regional finals over the last 2 days, people are calling it the best weekend ever in the history of college basketball. Three of the four games went into overtime. One of them went to double overtime. All three of the other ones, except Carolina's, were thrilling, exciting. Either team could have won those games. So now North Carolina looks like, well, they just eased into the Final Four, when in fact they had a really rough road. But the other three teams, it could very easily have been the other three teams that were in those games in the regional finals. Very thrilling game. A lot of excitement building up to the Final Four this weekend.
And in a sense, a rough road to get here. I mean, you talked about the disappointing seasons not long ago, and a lot has been made about the coach, Roy Williams, who's brought the program back. He might be the fourth alumnus in the past 40 years to win a national championship at the school he attended?
Yeah, if he does it with North Carolina, it's a very hard thing to do, to come back and coach the team from the school from which you graduated. Roy Williams was never a player on Carolina's program, but he was a student assistant, went off and coached high school for a couple years, came back to Dean Smith's staff where he stayed for 10 years as an assistant coach. He really resisted coming back to North Carolina and didn't come back to North Carolina the first time around when Matt Doherty was hired. He did come back the second time. He was sort of pursued. And being an alumnus is just a difficult thing because so much is wrapped into it. Well, I think it's difficult for a couple reasons. One, you know, coaches put a lot of pressure on themselves anyway. Right. It's a very high-pressure job at the highest levels of college basketball. If you're an alumnus, you put even that much more pressure on yourself. It's happened locally here with Norm Sloan back in 1974 when North Carolina State won the national championship. He was an alumnus. He played for Everett Case. And, you know, he had a great basketball team. There was a lot of pressure on him to do it. They won. It's just a harder thing to do. It's a lot more pressure. You feel like you're more wrapped up in it. Roy Williams has been to four Final Fours with Kansas. This is his fifth. And I guarantee he feels a little more pressure now than he did in the four previous.
Well, you mentioned one of his coaching influences, Matt Doherty, whom, as you say, Roy Williams replaced, recruited most of the players on the roster before he was fired. So now what's going through his mind?
Well, Matt Doherty is in a unique position because he's been out of coaching since he left North Carolina. He did recruit the majority of players on this team, including all five starters. Mm-hmm. And a couple guys off the bench. The only guy who plays significant minutes who was not recruited by Matt Doherty is Marvin Williams, who's a very key part of the team. But Matt Doherty has an interesting relationship with Roy Williams. He was an assistant at Kansas for Roy Williams. Mm. Then he went to Notre Dame for a year, came back, coached Carolina for 3 years, was fired. And now he looks back and is looking on this team. And who knows what he's thinking, but there's got to be a certain amount of, gosh, I wasn't so bad at my job after all, was I? Because I recruited these great players. Matt Doherty, a pretty volatile individual, very up and down. He was very intense early on in his career at North Carolina, really received accolades for that. People were thirsty for that kind of attitude. Then it sort of turned the current group of juniors particularly was Rashad McCants, Raymond Felton, and Sean May, the core of the team now, really sort of had a tough time with Matt Doherty, which is why he's not there anymore. He's trying to get back into coaching in a couple different ways. But, you know, it's interesting. He's got to sort of be watching these games and going, gosh, maybe I wasn't so bad because the team I recruited is now in the Final Four.
Of course, the bad news about recruiting a great team is that you can lose them early, and that may be one of the things we have to watch for when this Final Four is over.
Yeah, one of the real sort of downsides of success in this modern day of Division I college basketball is if you go to the national championship game and win it, then the players sort of had this feeling of, well, I've done this. I've experienced everything I need to experience in college. And Carolina is so talent-laden, they could lose as many as three or four players early that go pro. Now, fans don't want to talk about this. The coaching staff and the players certainly don't want to talk about this because it's a little ways off. But inevitably, what happens right after the Final Four, that's the big story for the next 6 weeks. Which players are going pro? Which ones are not going pro? Carolina has a couple of guys who are projected first-round picks, a couple of what they call lottery picks, who would be picked very early and are assured millions and millions of dollars without ever stepping on the floor of an NBA arena. So it's really hard to turn down, especially if you go through the tournament, have all this success. Very few players will come back and want to feel like I need to experience this again before I go off to the pros. Now, if Carolina goes to the Final Four and loses in the semifinals or the national finals, sometimes players say, well, you know, there's unfinished business there. I'm going to come back and take care of this. But it's not something players or coaches or fans even want to talk about right now, but it's down the road, and it's certainly on the top of people's minds.
It seems to me that that's something that makes college coaching so much different, especially in basketball, even different than football and some of the other sports, is that it becomes a completely different game because you have to keep a team together, or you can't if you've got really good talent.
Boy, that's exactly right. The coaching is so much different now than it was even 10 or 20 or 15 years ago, because then you recruited guys and sort of expected for them to stay 4 years. It was the rare player who would leave early. Now, there are a lot of guys you'll recruit who will go straight to from high school to the pros. And if you keep a guy for 1 or 2 years, a lot of times that's pretty remarkable. Mm-hmm. So you really have to recruit differently. There used to be an unwritten rule at North Carolina that you didn't recruit over players you already had in the program. In other words, if you had a really good power forward, you didn't go out and recruit another great power forward. Well, North Carolina can't afford to do that anymore because the great power forward isn't going to stay 4 years. They're going to go after a year or two. And so you've got to constantly just reload with great talent. And that's the problem that college coaches face these days.
So we've been talking about the men's program, but the women are also in the midst of a national basketball tournament.
They are, and North Carolina and Duke are still in the tournament. North Carolina's women's team, just like its men's team, is a number one seed. They play Monday night for a chance to go to the Final Four. North Carolina's team, after winning a national championship in the late 90s, had sort of hit some tough times, and they're just now sort of coming back to national prominence. Meanwhile, Duke's women's team, from that period in the late 90s and forward, have been one of the dominant teams in women's basketball, not quite to the level of a Connecticut or a Tennessee, but one step below that. Duke is also playing. They're a number two seed. They play Monday night. They're going to try for a fourth Final Four in the past 6 years. They play LSU, which is the overall number one seed in the whole women's tournament. So for both North Carolina and Duke to make the Final Four is a bit of a long shot, especially for Duke, but they could both do it. Unlike the men, where Duke and North Carolina State were both out here in the Sweet 16 round.
What happened there?
Well, it was great buildup here in the Triangle. People were really excited about North Carolina State, Duke, and North Carolina all being in the Sweet 16. People thought Duke and Carolina and NC State are going to meet in the regional final, and then whoever wins that is going to play Duke in the national semifinal. Mm-hmm. Didn't happen that way. NC State and Duke were both teams that didn't have great talent, but pretty good talent. Great coaches that got them that far. They both fell in games in the Sweet 16 round.
All right, so let's look ahead. Carolina faces Michigan State in the national semifinal, and that's on Saturday. And then we've got Illinois and Louisville also playing on that day. So what are Carolina's chances of taking the whole thing?
Carolina has a pretty good chance. Duke, they play Michigan State, which is just a thrilling game over Kentucky in the regional final. They'll be well prepared. It'll be a tight game. North Carolina's a little more talented. And then they'll play, as you said, the winner could be Illinois. Illinois is the number one seed in the whole tournament. A North Carolina-Illinois final would be great for college basketball. It would be great, for CBS, who's broadcasting it. They'd be really excited. And, you know, they would have to mark off Franklin Street if North Carolina made the final game, because it would be a thrilling Monday night.
How does Louisville fit into that whole picture?
Louisville's playing really well. They played a thrilling game as well in the regional final, win over West Virginia. Rick Pitino has now taken three teams to the Final Four, the only coach in history to do that. So he's a very prepared coach, probably of all the coaches there, with the exception of Roy Williams. the most prepared. Rick Pitino is the only coach of the four who's won a national championship. So, you know, Louisville's got a really good shot, too.
And what can we expect on Franklin Street if there's a if there's a win, is it even Saturday night?
Well, the last time they had to close down Franklin Street during the Final Four was when Duke lost the 99 championship game to Connecticut. They're hoping for a more positive reason to close down the street this year. You know, Franklin Street is a great place to go if you're looking for a certain kind of environment before or after a game. There have been a lot of bonfires. There have been all kinds of things this year. You know, the Franklin Street scene will be great. Fans, like the players, like the coaches of Carolina, expect North Carolina to be in a Final Four. But like I said, the enthusiasm is a little bit higher this year because it's been a five-year drought because of Roy Williams and because if you just go straight by talent, North Carolina probably has the best team in the Final Four.
All right. Well, we will see. Dave DeWitt, senior editor here at WUNC, also the author of the book True Blue, which chronicles the Tar Heels from 2000-2001 season. Dave, thanks very much.
Thanks, Frank.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. One morning a few years ago, when poet A. Van Jordan was visiting his hometown of Akron, Ohio, he came across a story of a young girl named Magnolia. She was 13 years old and the first African-American ever to reach the final round of the National Spelling Bee. The year was 1936. Legend has it Southern judges cheated Magnolia out of the title by giving her a word not on the official list. The word was nemesis. The irony and the poetry of that moment was not lost on A. Van Jordan. His newest book of poems is called Magnolia, and it's an exploration of the girl of the same name, her life, and her times. A. Van Jordan joins us now in the studio. Welcome, Van.
Thanks, Frank.
You can give us a call at 877-962-9862 to join our conversation to talk about the subject matter of this book, which is race and race relations. But it's also, we talk a little bit about poetry and art and its ability to illuminate and transform. And give us a call at 877-962-9862. Van, fascinating book. It's a big subject, and it's taken from the point of view of a single life.
Right.
Was this the book you had in mind when you came across that story?
Strangely enough, yes, on the grander scale, but I didn't see it as a single story that might illuminate this larger issue. I was actually researching the migration from the South to the North during that time period, and just on a fluke came across her story and thought, okay, this fits that theme. But the more I delved into her life, the more I realized that this is the human story that could tell this full story about that time period.
And what was it particularly that caught your eye?
Well, I was struck first by the fact that I hadn't heard about Magnolia Cox before.
Yeah.
Grew up in that town. Grew up in the black community in that town. My parents, in their 70s, would have been around during that time. They had no knowledge about her. And so I thought that was bizarre. And so I wanted to follow up on that. And the more I read about her and did research, the more I unearthed how her story related to many other stories during that time period.
Yeah, how much had been written about her? I mean, how much did you find?
Very little. Most of the archival research I found came from a reporter, Mabel Norris, who's a very progressive, sort of a maverick reporter of her time, who was given the assignment of writing about the spelling bee in 1936 in this newsroom that ostensibly was sort of the old boy system. They thought, oh, well, Mabel will let you cover the spelling bee.
Yeah, she's the woman. So
exactly,
you
right,
cover,
yeah, right.
Okay.
You know, so the stars were just aligned properly to put Mabel Norris with this story. Yeah. And so she ends up chronicling all the discrimination that she faces on the journey from Akron, Ohio, across the Mason-Dixon line to Washington, D.C.
And Mabel was white.
Yes, she was white.
Yeah. The reporter. So she chronicles that, and then she writes the story, and she did a few follow-up stories.
Yeah, there were a good number of follow-up stories, and those were the stories that really drew me into seeing this as a book. One of the articles was an editorial that she'd written as she retired from a newspaper in Florida. And you know, at the end of her career, they asked, well, what was the story that you remember that was your favorite story that you've written over your career? And she goes back to this early story in Akron, Ohio, writing about the spelling bee. tells the story all over again.
You write a number of poems that examine the love life of Magnolia mm-hmm. Cox as she grows up and the aftermath. She was going to become, or had plans to become, a doctor.
Exactly.
And those fell apart, I guess, when she lost the spell.
Right. She was a very precocious child and had an IQ of a genius, memorized 100,000 words. And when she got to D.C., she couldn't stay at the hotels because there was a segregated town at the time. So where the other district champs were staying, she couldn't stay. So she had to stay in the quote-unquote safe house. And this was the home of Dr. T. Edward Jones, who was a prominent black surgeon in D.C. at the time. And that was all she needed to motivate her. She said, this is what I want to do when I grow up. But then the course of events sort of took that spirit out of her.
Did she have a sense that she had been cheated at the time? Was there an attempt to protest and overturn the decision?
Yeah. Mabel Norris was the person who actually raised the protest. And she, right there on the spot, and then followed up with it again later as well. I think it may have been beyond Magnolia's scope at 13 to understand the gravity of it. But nonetheless, she felt it. And I think she, as time went on, internalized it and it became a part of who she was. I think she carried it for the rest of her life.
Your poetry talks about there are many inner dialogues that take place. We're taking a look at sort of what's going on, going through her mind. I'm assuming that's the poet in you, that there wasn't too much documentation.
Yeah, a good deal of that was my trying to approximate the emotion in her life. And, you know, would talk to Magnolia's niece, and she would tell me what that relationship was like. But once again, that was from her niece's perspective as a little girl trying to make sense of what was happening with her aunt and her uncle. So I can only rely on that so much. And then the rest of it was just sort of thinking about the sort of pressures that must have been on that relationship at that time.
Yeah, in the poem On Stage, where, you know, it's on page 102, we won't read all of it, but just at the end in the italics here, where she's sort of imagining what her mother might be saying.
Mm-hmm. Say the letters clearly so they don't think all Negro girls have thick tongues. Don't give them a reason to stop letting people like you compete. They already know you're not smart enough. Don't confirm it by losing. Don't look unkempt. I told you to soak in the tub before you go on stage. I told you don't stay in the sun too long the week before you go on stage. You don't want to look too black under those lights on stage. Change your drawers before you go on stage. Polish your shoes with Kiwi Black. Brush your teeth with baking soda. Moisten your skin with cocoa butter. I wish you would go on stage, ashy. Don't go on stage, ashy. I wish you would go on stage crying. Don't go on stage crying. Keep your back erect, even if you miss a word. Keep your back erect, even if they call you a word you don't like. Tell me you know what fork to use. Tell me you wore a slip under that dress. Tell me that's ribbon in your hair. Tell me you washed your hair and used oil. Tell me you know the winning word. You gotta listen when they say the word. You gotta repeat it so they know you know it. Let me hear you spell it like there are no more words left to spell. Voluble. V-O-L-U-B-L-E.
Evan Jordan from his new book, Magnolia, that takes a look at the life of Magnolia Cox in 1936. And that's, in a sense, a commentary on how success is as painful and difficult for African Americans as failure.
Sure. It's a vulnerability that you're placed in.
Reed, there's another poem, and I love the way you do this because it's a spelling bee. We've got entries from a dictionary.
Right.
And you take prepositions and turn them into to dictionary entries, and then they become poems. Read the poem from.
Sure. Nine definitions of the word from. And this is kind of in Magnolia's voice, dealing with the night that the first night she spends with her husband-to-be, John. From. One, starting at a particular place or time, as in John was from Chicago, but he played guitar straight from the Delta. He wore a blue suit from Robert Hall's. His hair smelled like coconut. His breath like mint and bourbon. His hands felt like they were from slave times when he touched me, hungry, stealthy, trembling. Two. Out of. He pulled a knot of bills from his pocket, paid the man, and we went upstairs. 3. Not near to or in contact with. He smoked the weed, but surprisingly, he kept it from me. He said it would make me too self-conscious, and he wanted those feelings as far away from us as possible. He said a good part of my beauty was that I wasn't conscious of my beauty. Isn't that funny? So we drank Bloody Mothers, Hennessy and tomato juice, which was hard to keep from him. He always did like to drink. 4. Out of the control or authority of. I was released from my mama's house, from dreams of hands holding me down, from the threat of hands not pulling me up, from the man that knew me but of whom I did not know, released from the dimming of twilight, from the brightness of morning, from the love I thought had to look like love, from the love I thought had to taste like love, from the love I thought I had to love like love. 5. Out of the totality of. I came from a family full of women. I came from a family full of believers. I came from a pack of witches. I'm just waiting to conjure my powers. I came from a legacy of lovers. I'm just waiting to seduce my seducer. I came from a pride of proud women, and we take good care of our young. 6. As being other or another than. He couldn't tell me from his mother. He couldn't tell me from his sister. He couldn't tell me from the last woman he had before me. And why should he? We're all the same woman. 7. With some person, place, or thing as the instrument maker or source. Here's a note from my mother, and you can take it as advice from me. A weak lover is more dangerous than a strong enemy. If you're going to love someone, make sure you know where they're coming from. 8. Because of. Becoming an alcoholic, learning to walk away, being a good speller, being good in bed, falling in love, they all come from practice. 9. Outside or beyond the possibility of. In the room, he kept me from leaving by keeping me curious. He kept me from drowning by holding my breath in his mouth. Yes, he kept me from leaving till the next day when he said, leave. Then he couldn't keep me from coming back.
It amazes me how the ideas of separation and attraction are contained in this same little preposition.
Right.
There are a lot of different styles in the poems, in the poems that make up this book, this chronicle, and poems about other people, poems about Jesse Owens and Richard Pryor. How did the project come together in your mind? Did it come together as a piece?
Well, I looked at different figures in Black history that I thought in some way were emblematic of that time. So they serve as time markers in the book. I wanted to place her in that spectrum as one of these people that whose story was just as compelling as theirs, but we just hadn't heard of her before. So as opposed to just saying the 1930s or 1970s, I would say, well, Asa Philip Randolph, Josephine Baker, Richard Pryor, and put their stories in there as well.
It's kind of interesting that Jesse Owens, of course, won his gold medals in Munich in 1936, the year she lost.
Exactly.
Your poem, though, is not. It talks about meeting him in 63.
I don't exactly.
Know, tell us a little bit about that poem and what was going on there.
This is a poem that came about from living in Akron and hearing this story growing up about Jesse Owens showing up at the Hall of Fame as a special guest to do the induction ceremony. And by all reports, he shows up drunk. So all these people from Northeast Ohio go to the Hall of Fame to see Jesse Owens. Finally, they have a chance to see Jesse Owens. And then they see him and they're so disappointed or so hurt to see him drunk. And so that's his story, but it also is a precursor to what happens later to Magnolia, also from that time.
Tell us a little bit more. It would appear from the poems in this book that she had a very bad marriage. Do you know that for a fact? Is this research?
That's by reports I've heard from people in the community and in interviews. But there was a lot of love in the marriage as well. It was just a difficult marriage. And probably would be considered more difficult today than back then by their standards then. So it was just it was a relationship.
And she did housework.
Exactly, she was in service as a domestic.
And you have a lovely poem in there that talks about her the man she worked with, mm-hmm. who sort of describes her in fairly flat terms.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And did you interview him?
No,
talk to him,
I didn't.
Or is this based on
based on what I've heard, and it sort of approximates the relationship.
Yeah. Would you consider her life, would you call it a tragedy? Is it tragic?
To some degree, I would. I mean, I think there's a certain transcendence that we come to just knowing that this woman, despite all of her adversity that she faced, she still was self-contained. She still held all this power within her. And there were reports of her still being sort of a trivia champion. Like if there was a game show on, she knew all the answers. So there were still vestiges of this keen mind that was present, but it just was sort of in the embodiment of this domestic. So I would imagine people would see her and probably dismiss her. Oh, this woman's going to, you know, to clean someone's home today, and not realize that woman's a genius. You know, this woman, you know, she's got this great mind. You know, so
did she become bitter?
It's hard for me to speak on that. I never got any indication from anyone I talked to. I spoke to some women who went to school with her. I talked to her niece, and that was never a part of what seemed to be her her personality. People would talk about her infectious laugh, how she wouldn't use profanity, you know, and she just different quirky things about her, but nothing that seemed to speak to that.
If it's not in the dictionary, she's not going to use it.
Right.
You know, I have to confess, when I found myself a little disappointed, even though I could certainly understand her not becoming a doctor, not going through with her education after this bitter defeat, but I was disappointed. I mean, you know, and maybe this gets to our hero worship, the whole business what we expect of people in that.
Sure.
Well, then we expect you to, you know, sort of take the grit and move
right,
forward.
Exactly.
And I was disappointed she didn't.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's the sort of Horatio Alger story that we'd like to hear.
Yeah.
But and that was the one of the artistic problems I had to deal with, because I was disappointed as well. I wanted to have that happy ending. Mm-hmm. And when I had written the book, I realized, oh, man, this is really, you know, a downer. You know, so that's when I played with the structure and started with the end of her life and moved back in time to that moment of her greatest potential, because I felt that in some way it brought us to some level of transcendence in reading this story without having that that disappointment at the end.
So this can certainly be a story about life for African Americans and the African American experience, but it tells us a lot about the broader experience.
Yeah, the human experience.
The human experience, and also, I guess, the American experience.
Absolutely.
How, I guess, we're not prepared to tell the stories that don't meet our expectation. Her
right.
story would have been lost had you not picked it up. And what kind of response have you gotten since this book has been published?
I've been very fortunate. This is it's been really rewarding, because I feel like people have connected with it on a spiritual level. I mean, people they read the story and they it sort of has the universality of specificity. You know, you don't have to be a little black girl from Akron, Ohio, 1936 to understand what this felt like. You know. And so I've been very happy with the response.
Did you find yourself unearthing things in yourself?
Sure. That, every time I sit down and write a poem, I find that. But I learned a great deal writing this book. And I felt like certainly I polished my chops a bit trying to put her story into these poems. But also just about my own, you know, personal challenges. So it was great.
The book is called Magnolia. It is written by A. Van Jordan. It's a poem about a girl. It's set, as we said, you've got big picture and the little picture in here. There's a story about Richard Pryor, and I wasn't quite sure. Did you write that? Has that been extracted, or how? Because it seemed to be taken from a newspaper article or a...
I read a couple of biographies of Pryor, and of course watched all his tapes and took in the experience of listening to him, you know, sneaking into my brother's rooms and listening to his tapes when I was a kid, you know.
Yeah.
Most of that story is straight from him.
Yeah.
And
there
are
how he met Mudbone and transformed
that,
his
exactly.
act.
Exactly. Yeah. That's his story. It's sort of his vision quest that he had.
A story of transformation. A. Van Jordan is with us today. We are talking about his new collection of poems, Magnolia, and his move to the South. We'll talk a little bit more about that and take your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking this hour with poet A. Van Jordan, who teaches at UNC Greensboro, and is author of a poetry collection called Magnolia. And we are invited to join our conversation at 877-962-9862 to talk about the subject of the book, which is Magnolia Cox, a young girl who was 13 in 1936 and almost won the National Spelling Bee, but she was African-American and the judges wouldn't have it, so she didn't. But also about the power of poetry and art to illuminate and to transform. And in fact, your journey as a poet, Van, it was not typical. You didn't start out to be a poet. Maybe no poet does, but
right,
tell us about
right.
your...
Well, I was living in D.C. and working as an environmental journalist at the time. And I had studied literature in undergrad at Wittenberg University. And but for me, that was simply a way to also have a concentration in journalism. So I wasn't really interested in literature in that sense. By the time I had gone to college, I had only read two books, two novels at that time. And so I wasn't a literary child. I wasn't someone who grew up holding a book, and I didn't have the kind of background that Magnolia had. So I got interested in the literary scene in D.C., and start hanging out at coffee shops and listening to poets and jazz and
keeping bad company.
Yeah, exactly right. I was attracted to it. So I got involved there. Started opening old trunk of mine that had books in it from college and started going back through those. Finally reading them, And so that was my my entrance to poetry.
And there was a moment, was there not?
November 15th, 1994, I was at the Folger Shakespeare Theater, and I had seen Cornelius Eady give a reading. And he opened with this poem, Gratitude, which is this sort of ars poetica, this long, beautiful poem about his life and about the process of becoming a writer. And I was sitting there in the audience at the Folger, and I was the only black person in the audience, and the place was packed. And it dawned on me halfway through the poem that this was the first time I had ever seen an African-American male poet at a formal academic, quote-unquote, reading. And the poem that he was reading chronicled his life growing up in Rochester, which is not that different from Akron, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And so... I found myself in the middle of this guy's poem. I started to cry, and it caught me off guard because I'd never been moved in that way by art. I'm not demonstrative in that way. Usually, mm-hmm. I don't cry in movies and things. And so, it caught me off guard. But then I realized this: the power of it. And before he finished that poem, I said to myself, this is what I'm going to do. And afterwards, I met him. I met E. Ethelbert Miller, who is a great poet and sort of a literary impresario in D.C. And both of them embraced me and were mentors.
There's always this debate about whether art can be political, whether all art is political, whether art cannot never be political. Mm-hmm. And you seem to balance the two, particularly in this book, again, with the personal and the social. Where do you come down on that?
I think it really is in the hands of the reader. Your first mission, I think, is just to, well, for me at least, is to get as close to the truth as possible with whatever subject matter you're dealing with. And so I'm wrestling with all the artistic problems of doing that. And you never know how someone will respond to that, though. Someone might find that truth that it chafes them in some way, and then it does... seem political because it becomes polemical, and so now you're dealing with that. But I think all art can be political in that sense.
There's a poem, and I want to go back to the book if I can get you to read the poem Mercy for us, because in a sense it has certainly a social connection because of your inspiration for this poem.
Sure. Okay, this is a weird poem. I'll do my best with that. I don't usually read it. You know, the structure is sort of playing with the screenplay structure.
Yeah.
So the title comes from the Cannonball Adderley tune, Mercy, Mercy, Mercy. And this is in the voice of John Montier on the day of Magnolia's death.
And that's her husband.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
September 12, 1976. Mercy, mercy, mercy. Interior, night. Panning shot of Magnolia's bedroom on her deathbed. The melody seeps through her room like a bad man's walk. Something sexy in one step, something sinister in the other. The bed's bones creak as death slips under the sheets. Nightstands at either side of her headboard hold her combs while the sun cries mercy at 7 p.m. She looks up scared from her book's curled yellow pages as the room fills with staccato breaths from Adderley's reed. My eyes melt under my tongue's flame as I stand at the door of her room. She sees me now and looks out again. Her lips curl like dry burning leaves into a smile, and her fingers trace half notes in the air. Am I water drawn for your bath? Am I the needle's cry across the album's grooves? Am I this song's moan over your moist body? Interior, day, flashback to John's father, soft shot. In September, like this September, long ago, my sand-skinned father, the steelworker, turned up my collar on my one white shirt and twirled his hands into a silk brown Windsor knot. A figure rising and coming home at sunup and passing me, his punch to the shoulder I held all day, his open hand on my mother's face I held all night. I am my young eyes blazing scenes in the dark, his son sorting the language of his touch, which taught me of the twin angels, joy and pain, asleep in a man's palms, always awakened by those whom he owes so much. Don't ask where I learned to soothe a dying woman's last days with these hands. Ask why I am afraid even now to let her fly.
A. Van Jordan from his new book, Magnolia, collection of poetry. You credit or list here you Philip Levine as I suspect the inspiration.
Sure.
Tell us about him a little bit and how he inspired you.
Well, Levine is one of these poets who also comes from a blue collar Midwestern town, and I'm sure reading the corpus of his work, he's gone through these different phases where he's dealing with the blue-collar lifestyle and then coming to a hipper scene like New York City and dealing with jazz musicians and things like that. And so I followed his work and I've been inspired by it in many ways. His poem is a much more narrative poem dealing directly with the family and sort of the flashbacks of life. But it has given rise to a lyrical poem now that I think in some ways inspired by that. So I just wanted to say that this was the inspiration, structurally at least, for the poem.
And speaking of that blue collar background, you told me a minute ago that probably if you hadn't left Ohio, you might not be a poet.
Yeah, there wasn't much of a literary scene in Akron, Ohio. Mm-hmm. So you know, people, you know, if you were a man, you got up and you went to work in the morning, and you know, that's what you did. You know, so the idea of pursuing an art form. Something that wasn't quite as tangible as a 9-to-5 that had benefits wasn't something that was really respected in the same way. So,
the other thing that's always struck me about life in blue collar towns is the amount of racial tension among people who have so much in common and are easily distracted and easily divided.
Mm-hmm. It's bizarre. It's a bizarre dynamic because what happens is that these folks work together online in a plant somewhere. They're just fine. They're just fine at the union meetings and these things. But then they go to their separate segregated neighborhoods, and you never cross those lines. It's almost like an invisible fence around these neighborhoods. And, you know, when I look at the country, you know, it's not very different from the urban planning that's going on in most cities around the country, but I think it's a bit more stark in those communities.
Is that what's behind, when I read Magnolia's Dream of Shirley Temple, and again, this is sort of a great poetic leap. You're really sort of reaching into her imagination, I assume. Is that where this comes from? We can tell the sad tale in the dominant society, but we have to tell it with Shirley Temple. We certainly can't tell it about the people who are really suffering.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing about Shirley Temple, I think she works sort of as a, not even a foil, but really a reflector of Magnolia's experience, because here's someone, as a nation, we watched as an adorable, precocious kid grow up and ostensibly not really live up to her potential. We sort of lost interest in her once she became a woman, as opposed to this cute child. And that's the side of her story that I think is sometimes not talked about as much. And when we think about her relationship to Bill Robinson, Bojangles Robinson, we always think of her as being this little girl that he sort of played the minstrel dancer, you know, to, and that was their relationship. But I also wanted to talk a bit about how difficult it must have been from that perspective, and how it was also similar to Magnolia's experience. And I just sort of put them together to see how that would play out.
How it plays out. I mean, the poem begins, or about midway through, a movie in which Shirley is loved only by the unloved, and even then needed to be convinced. Again, we can tell the sad story, but it needs to be Shirley Temple's face that we see.
Yeah, yeah.
In this poem. We're talking to A. Van Jordan. The book is Magnolia, and you're teaching now at UNC Greensboro. Well, tell us about your own migration. You moved to the South, and you said you didn't find it particularly comfortable in North Carolina at first.
Well, my first couple of weeks in North Carolina actually was in Asheville, North Carolina, and it's a great town. I like Asheville. I was there on a fellowship at Warren Wilson College, a very progressive and fun school to teach at. But, you know, the first couple of weeks I was here, I kept getting stopped by the police. And I'm driving around in an old 95 Chevy Beretta, and I'm wondering, like, why do they keep stopping me? You know, because this is an experience I never had up north, particularly in a car like that. And the reason is because I had out-of-state tags. And so they never understood. They said, well, why is this, you know, they were stopping like, why is this black guy here with tags from out of town? And so they would stop me and ask me, why are you here? And I, you know, think this was a strange question to be asked in America. I mean, I'm driving through my country, you know, so, yeah. But of course, you know, you don't say that to the police. You
know? No, no, no.
And so that was my introduction to the South. And having two parents who came from the South, that's what they warned me of along the way. So there's been that aspect of living here. But like anywhere else, you meet people that you connect with spiritually as well. And that's been good as well.
How about teaching, working both as, you know, in academia, but also trying to write? Does teaching help or hinder?
Yeah, well, it's been a good experience for me at UNC Greensboro in particular, because I have good students. And so it's you have the ability to share ideas with them. And the exchange of ideas and a dialogue, it helps to fertilize my my creative juices as well as theirs, hopefully. And it's a good, you know, where else do you get to have an opportunity to talk about poetry in your day-to-day, you know, lifestyle? So it's a great environment for that.
This sounds like a difficult project for an artist in the sense that you're working with material that's, you know, nonfiction. I mean, in other words, it's not, you're not sort of sitting in your garret. You know, you've got this material to work with.
Yeah.
Do you feel much duty bound to be faithful to the story?
Absolutely. I because, you know, I don't have the Gore Vidal sort of background. When I entered this, I felt a bit intimidated by the idea of handling someone's life and the history in that way. But I've had some experiences that have validated. One I gave a reading in Akron, Ohio, and a woman who was a woman I had met before who had been at the parade when she came back from the spelling bee in Akron, Ohio. She stood up and addressed the audience in the Q&A period. And then she says, I just wanted to thank you for writing this book, you know, because I was there at the parade and you've captured the spirit of that moment. And I just really appreciate someone telling the story. So I felt then that I had done my job at that point.
How about during the process when you had to interview a few people, didn't mm-hmm, you? Were people sort of reluctant to talk about the story? This failure, we don't want to revisit this.
Yeah, well, you know, surprisingly not. I mean, people were open to talking about it, but there were certain nuances of the family development, the dynamic rather in the family, that I wasn't able to develop because the niece was reticent about talking too much from Magnolia's mother's diary. So I got excerpts from that, but I couldn't get the whole diary itself. So I did what I could with what I had to work with.
Well, I think it's brilliant. And A. Van Jordan, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
A. Van Jordan teaches poetry at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. His latest collection of poems is called Magnolia. That's the state of things for today. Thank you for listening. You can send us a comment at sot@wunc.org. Support for the state of things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Frank Stachow.